Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 19th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Job, Jennifer, and Jesus, The Pain of Pious Answers to Suffering, presented by Norm Hobble. The tape number is HAN 2002-14. Let's listen in.
This is Job, Jennifer, and Jesus. Now, I'm from Australia, and most of you probably know where Australia is, but probably know very little about it. So, I'm not going to tell you about it, which, if you're interested, I will, but we did have a session on Australia on Saturday, which was great fun. But every once in a while, I may say something that you do not understand. I mean, my English might be not American. And every once in a while I get into trouble.
It's a treat.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah. You want me to talk Australian all the time, do you?
I'd love it. Call me Sarah. Would I be a Sarah?
Would I be a Sarah?
No, I would. No, what do they call girls that are...
Sheila.
Sheilas.
I'm a bloke and you're a Sheila.
That's right.
Oh. In Australia, call them Sheilas. Well, I used to, you know, that was sort of... But, you know, when I first came to America, I had just arrived, very recently after I'd arrived, there was a woman there who had a friend of ours who had a very lovely little baby. And I looked at her and I said, oh, do you mind if I would nurse your baby? And she looked at me and she said, what kind of a man are you? So little things like that. You say, how you doing? We say, how you going? Mm-hmm. You say, what are you doing? And you say, how are you doing? And all these little nuances. However, once you get into the book of Job, all of that will be... Yeah. Once in a while, you might, you know. Like in the sermon last night, I was listening and he says, and Jesus was 0-2. And I said, what? I don't know if that's it. What? 0-2? You've got to be an American to know what 0-2
is. Oh, it could be forget.
It's a baseball expression. Well, it's very interesting. You just fall into it, of course. It happens all the time. So it may happen once in a while. And if I do an Australian session, of course, I can throw them in all the time and enjoy it. But we're going to look at something today called Job, Jennifer, and Jesus. It all started really some time ago when I was asked to fill in by the younger generation at our church to fill in. And so for Lent, I did this series on Job, Jennifer, and Jesus through Lent. And it's become virtually now a kind of retreat workshop on healing. It's become a healing process. Stages of healing for people who are suffering extreme pain, spiritual hurt, hurt of the soul of one kind or another. And so I tend to be a bit more subdued in this than I am in some of my other lectures where I get rather animated. And on Wednesday when I do the Purple Puzzle Tree, I am very animated. That's for children of all ages. So come along. But the story about Job, Jennifer, and Jesus is important because lots of people in the church still have not often faced up to or dealt with extreme pain from their past of one kind or another. And the pains may be very, very severe. And they may eventually need special counseling, but this is a starting point, and for some people a very important healing process. But in order to do it, we go through a process of the story of Job, the story of Jennifer, and how Jesus links up with it. And given the Bible study in this, you know, Jesus does make a difference when you link it up with the stories of your lives. Now, the important point is that I need to tell you a little bit about this book called Job. I've spent my life studying the book. I've written a couple of books and a major commentary back in 85, which is now widely used in seminaries. And if I die, the one thing I think that the last will be my book on Job. I mean, forget the rest, that one was a worthwhile piece of work. But to understand Job, you need to know just a little bit about the book. I'm not going to give you a lot. First of all, we have no idea when it was written. We have no idea who wrote it, and yet it's one of the greatest masterpieces of English literature. It really is a remarkable piece of literature. And you need to know it is a piece of literature, first and foremost. It's not history. We have no idea who or where this person was. It's somebody set back way before Abraham, somebody who is a human being. And so the focus, we have no connections with any point in history, with any point in the story. It's a universal story. That's the first thing. Don't try and connect it with history. Otherwise, it's just you spoil the whole thing. Connect it with human life. It connects with the experiences of everybody who's had severe suffering at some point. When you hear it, you say, yes, yes, David, yes. You know, time and again, you say that. Now, for that reason, I don't spend time worrying about history, but I do need to say a little bit about the structure of the book. Because, putting it bluntly, Job is framed. Job is framed both by God, by the writer, and by the structure of the book. Job is framed. And to understand the book of Job, you need to know that there is what's called a frame story. That is a story, a narrative, that frames all of the cries and screams and poetry of the book. And at various points, there is a little narrative that keeps you going and tells you we've moved another step. So all along the line, you've got this frame, and chapters 1 and 2 and chapter 42 are in strict prose, and they are very carefully set up as the frame for the story. And inside of this, you've got all kinds of things, and if your frame is frequently in the Bible, if your frame is orthodox, you can do all kinds of stuff inside the frame. The book of Ecclesiastes is often called said to be, because it argues that, you know, Ecclesiastes is way out in left field. But because the first verse is said to be by Solomon, and the last verse says, you know, if you obey the law, you're okay, the rest of it is way out. It's explorations of ideas. And Job is also the critique of the world of orthodoxy of their time. Ill in the middle of this. So it's important to know that Job is framed. He's framed by the story. And so you have the narrative and moments along the way, and then the big moment when God appears in the whirlwind. That's a short piece of narrative, and then the final ending in chapter 42. Now, we won't have time to go through all the fine details, and that's not important. What is important to know is that Job is framed. But the framing of the story is then related to the framing of the person. How does the story start? And if you want to look at the beginning of it, you can, but I'm just going to ramble through it. And remember, I am no problem if you want to interrupt at any point and say, I don't understand your idea of Australian or your theology. One of the two. Don't be afraid to interrupt. My children do it all the time. It starts with a man called Job sitting here in the ancient world, way back when. And what is true about Job that's distinctive? Job is?
Prosperous.
Has it all. Absolutely. He has it all. He is not only has it all, he is it all. He is described as the greatest man in the ancient world. Who's the greatest man in your ancient world? Who's the greatest man in American history? Well, there must be one.
Finding out they're not so great.
Okay, well, there you go. All right. Anyway, he's the greatest, right? He's the greatest. And with all these accolades, and this star of the ancient world is here, right? And he's got everything, and he is everything, and he's not only so has everything done, but he's the wisest man. And in addition, if his children do something wrong, not if his children do something, he says every day, every weekend after they've had their evening, he says, maybe my children thought about doing something wrong. So he has sacrifices for the possibility of his children making sin. It can't go any further than that with piety. He's the most pious, he's the most wise, he's the most wealthy, he's the greatest. Point one. So you set up. come in. In Australia, if we set somebody up like that, the first, somehow you're going to lop them off. We call them tall poppies. Anybody who's set up to be that great, we're going to find a way to lop the tops off of. A lot of our literature is just that, poppy lopping. Cutting the heroes down to size. We have a kind of anti-hero literature and perspective on the world. So none of our great people ever get to be real heroes. Now, Job is, however, portrayed so... You've got to somehow... There's got to be something wrong with the guy. How surely? So, he's then set up. God has a council meeting. And in the ancient world, this is common. The idea that the gods meet, divine beings meet, and they have a session about life on earth. This is common in the ancient world. It's not new. It's very common. And so the council meets, and you've got God. And in addition to God, you've got what would have been called in the ancient world one of the, what do we call them? CIA, you know, the group that wanders around the earth looking at things, you know, checking it out. They are the monitors of what's going on. And the guy that's been the monitor is called the accuser. And that's the wrong spelling. The accuser. And he appears before the council of heaven, and all the council is there, and so you've got, and he's called, otherwise called Satan, the Satan, means the accuser. He's not the devil, that's later literature. He's not the devil of later literature. He's simply that person in the council who is the prosecuting attorney. And God's the defense attorney. And so the council meets, and God says, all right, where you been? Oh, wandering to and fro on the earth. Which is fair enough, you know, it's his job. Wandering to and fro upon the earth, it's his job. Then God says, well, have you noticed Job? My, isn't he remarkable? You got this, God's proud.
My guy.
Boy, my boy. He's my boy, isn't he? Huh? He's my guy. So you've got this wonderful picture of God bragging about Job. And after he's finished bragging, the accuser, whose job it is to point out the faults, the mistakes, his job is to point out the mistakes, what does he say? Well.
Why not?
Well, is it for nothing?
Yeah.
Is it for nothing? What have you been doing, God? You have given him everything. You have blessed him and blessed him and blessed him. And if you bless somebody so much, well, of course he's going to be nice to you. So, then God says, my by George. Oh my God, or whatever. He says, you say that the reason why Job is so good is because I've given him all this stuff. He said, yeah. And then the accuser says, well, I will wager, I'll bet you, if you take away all of that, if you take away everything that Job has, then he will curse you to your face. And God scratches his immortal head and says, you're wrong. The bet is on. And so they make this wager. You have this wager in heaven, and the wager is that if the accuser takes away all these things that Job has, that he will then retaliate and curse God. Now, Job, what is he? Where does he sit in all this?
Ignorant.
Totally ignorant. Has no idea that he's been set up, framed. And lots of people feel that way when something happens. Huh? Not mine. Why did this happen? I've been set up. I've been framed. And so this writer has portrayed a scene where you've got a person who is not only an innocent sufferer, but an ignorant sufferer. He doesn't know that the deal has been done on high. Right? And therefore, it's a very clear-cut case of innocent suffering. Set it up as baldly and as forcefully as you could possibly do. So the course of events is that then Job loses all four things. All of his property, all of his animals, all of his trade. He had huge trade with camels and caravans. And he loses also all of his
children.
So Job loses everything excepting his wife. Now, everything goes, and the first expectation would be, after you lose everything, you might tend to want to say something very nice, not very nice. But the first stage in a lot of this suffering, when people suffer, one of the first stages that's very common is what I call an answer of denial. What does Job say? The Lord has given. The Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Wow. A pious platitude. A pious answer. You've lost everything. You've been set up. It's horrible. God's the guilty party. And you say, blessed be the Lord. Now, that answer, that pious answer, the full force of having pious platitudes and those kind of answers came home to me when I was at seminary. We went home for Christmas, and my brother and I, it was the day before Christmas, my brother and I went to play tennis down the road, had this old backboard. This was in 1953 or somewhere there. We went down and we had this phone call. Your home is on fire. We're 5 miles away. We roared home, virtually almost tipped the truck over. We got home and here was my home, a weatherboard house in the middle of the bush, totally in flames. Absolutely, totally in flames. No way you could get in. People came from everywhere. We lived out in the bush, but people just appeared from all over. And the Lutheran pastor came from wandering to and fro on the earth. And then he came up to me and said, Norman, Norman, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Oh, that made an impression on me. I felt like a Let's pause for a moment. That's extraordinary. Those kind of answers at that moment are totally insensitive, aren't they? I need to take the story one step further because you see it gets worse. The council meets again after all this loss, and God says, hey, I won, didn't I? Look at him. He's blessing me. He's blessing me even though he's lost everything. Now, I know it's your fault. You, and then God admits, you tricked me into doing this. You incited, the Hebrew says, you incited me to do this. But now even though I was sucked in by you, I have won. Of course, the accuser's not about to give up. All right, God. So you've won the first break. That's 0-1. But you won the first round, but you take away his health, his body, make him sick, and see what happens. I said, all right. He said, I bet you. God said, I bet you. The guy gets sucked in a second time. Remember, this is a story that's been set up to set Job up. It also sets God up in a second time, doesn't it? And so, God says, all right, you can take away everything, but I still bet. Then, he's sitting there with all his boils, and he stays in denial, and he finally says the last part of it, surely if God brings good to the world, God can also bring evil. And his wife who may be more sympathetic, says to him, what? I tell you what, Joe, you're in a heck of a shape. You're in misery. Why don't you put yourself out of your misery? Curse God and die. If he curses God, then God will have to retaliate to kill him. And that was her answer. The Job sits there, and so we have end of stage one. Job has gone through the denial and used all the pious platitudes that you normally have. Now I want you to pause for a moment and think, what are some of the typical pious platitudes, pious answers that people say when there's a disaster, when there's great suffering, when there's great pain?
It's God's will.
Hmm?
It's God's will.
It's God's will?
God won't give you any more than you can bear.
Bear, right.
Oh!
Yeah.
I would rather bear a little less, yes. That's right, you can't, that's one of them. You, God will never give you more than you can bear. And right at that moment, you don't need that.
When a door closes, a window will open.
Yes. Everything works out for good. That may have been terrible.
If you get dealt lemons, make lemonade.
Oh, I love it.
Did someone say it's their time? It was their time.
It's their time. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? But I love a lemonade. I haven't heard that.
Sometimes even Romans 8:28 just doesn't, you know,
just doesn't fit.
Fit right at that time.
You're still in denial. This has just happened. But those kind of answers don't work. Last week, when one woman said, well, there was a disaster, a crash, the child was killed, the answer was, Jesus wanted him for an angel.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Ah.
I have one more.
Yeah.
Too bad they never found their niche.
Wonderful. Oh. That's all. And there are a lot of these. Or, when you get to heaven, you'll understand. You know, when you have the final briefing, you'll know what it's all about. Or, it was sent to test your character. Because really, God does it, really because God loves you and really wants to give you the special treatment. So there's a whole lot of these, aren't there? And a lot of clergy simply begin by doing just that. Having that kind of an answer. And I would like to say that what Job is doing as you proceed, he's giving you the right to say shut up, not to accept the pious answer as the beginning for any suffering, but to allow the suffering to be experienced and as real. It is real. It's hell often. All kinds of suffering. So stage one, people are not ready for those kind of answers, and those kind of answers often squash people and prevent people from going through the pain, the agony that they need to go through. It's real. Questions? Now I want to introduce you to Jennifer. Read this story. And what kind of an answer would one give to Jennifer? What kind of an answer do people give? This is the story of Jennifer. To bring the problem of Jennifer, she was a quiet Christian woman struggling to make ends meet. She lived in a simple weatherboard house with a rather rough husband. They had a little boy called James. When she worked at night as a waitress in the local cafe, her husband looked after their boy, or so she thought. One night, the police came to the restaurant and told her the sad news. Her house had been burnt down and her boy, James, had been burned alive. He had tried to get out of the house, but the door was locked and he could not escape. The husband, who had apparently gone down to the pub for a drink, left the boy in the house, had vanished. Jennifer was alone, faced with the senseless and tragic loss of her son, her life, and her home. How do I counsel Jennifer? What do I say to her? Or Joe? condition was exactly the same as Job's. It was senseless. And it wasn't her fault. The answer for the next stage, I believe, comes in the next chapter of Job. And Job is a progression, I believe, through stages of coming to terms with great suffering. What happens when you turn from the end of that story in the first two chapters? Job sits for 7 days with three friends in absolute silence. Absolute silence, covered in boils, scrapings. And after 7 days, often in the Bible, 7 and 7 days is the period of transformation or transition. He moves out of denial. He begins to scream. To scream. And what Job does from the outset is give you the right to scream. To scream when you've gone through hell, when you've had that kind of thing happen to you. And how does he begin? Chapter 3. He begins, "Curse the day that I was born." Whole chapter of screaming. Curse the person who looked after me. Curse the womb. Curse everything. He curses long and hard. Screams. He curses and calls on the forces of destruction to remove his name, to remove the date from the calendar. He curses a whole series of curses. They are screams. Now, what does it mean when you curse someone? When you curse something? Or the opposite of bless. To bless, if I bless somebody, I put my hands on you and bless them, or in the old world sometimes different other parts of the body, you put your hand on and you bless. To bless is not just to say something nice. To pray. To best bless is to transfer power, energy. I become the vehicle for transferring energy from God or wherever through to that person. And so when somebody like Abraham blesses his servant, it's Abraham being the channel of power, divine power. So to bless is to channel God's power, or Christ's power, or the Eucharist's power. To curse is the opposite. To channel destruction is to invoke destruction upon somebody. So Job is actually at the very verge of it all. He is calling for destruction to come, the power of destruction to come on his birth, on the calendar, on all kinds of things in his past. He is basically screaming bloody murder. I wish I'd never been born. I, in fact, want to revoke my whole life. So Job screams. And I have, in counseling, quite frequently said, what you need to do first, or I invite you at first, to scream. Scream at everything and everybody and God, all that you need to scream at. The right to scream is given to you in the book of Job. And it's a very important part of the healing process. It's not the end, it's the beginning. Have a healing screaming room in your church, or the back of your church, or wherever. Or a ritual in which you're given the right to scream, a chance to scream. Because it's part of the process of letting it out. The pain and the anger and the anguish of senseless suffering.
Is wailing the same thing as screaming?
Yeah. For some people it is. Yes. Now, you hear what, that's right, you do hear wailing. You hear people, especially in traditional cultures, that really is, there it's screaming about grief. And so they're often grief and wailing get connected at that point. That's right. That's a good point. Thank you. Somebody else. so that now Job screams and he curses. He goes almost all the way. He curses virtually everything, but he does not curse God. He doesn't quite get there. But what you do notice, you see, is that Job is taking God absolutely seriously. He's not saying there is no God. Some people say when all this horrible disaster happens, there is no God. But Job says, oh yes, there's a God, and I'm going to have it out with it. I'm going to face God with it. I'm going to confront God with it, which is a heck of a lot more healthy than simply denying. Because you've lived with God all this time, and suddenly God seems to have betrayed you, or left you, or whatever. So then comes this crucial moment. Job says this. Now, one more thing about Jennifer. When I first went, Jennifer had a breakdown after this, which is understandable, and I had not met her yet. And when I first went to meet her, she was in a hospital ward, psychiatric ward, I think it was somewhere. And I just was accident that I came to meet her. And we talked a little bit, and I said, she said, oh, I can't stand it. I don't want to go on living. I just don't want to go on living. But she said, I don't have the courage to commit suicide. I said, well, you've got to go. What other option is there? And she said, oh, that I had never been born. And then the whole third chapter of Job opened up for me. I had not been in a position where I had actually thought that. This was purely voluntary. So this whole idea that you could somehow or another, in your despair and in your anger, really is somehow or another envision that it never happened at all. You go back to pre-birth. And that's quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. In addition then, what happens in Job, when he moves into these screams, the screaming of chapter 3, he moves from cursing to the point where he begins to be on the verge of suicide. When you go through that, when you're in despair, often the best solution, the most wonderful place on earth is death. And Job has these extraordinary pictures. Let me find my glasses. Extraordinary pictures of what it would be like if I were dead. Oh, how wonderful that would be. And so the actual glorification, the portrayal of death as being a place that's ideal. Just listen to a little bit of his.
Go to dishes.
Come back again another time. Chapter 3. He says, why was I not buried like a stillborn child? And go to the land of the dead. Then verse 17. There in that land, the wicked cease from troubling, the weary have rest, the prisoners are at ease together, they do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, the slave and the free, free from their masters. Everything's great there. Everybody's equal. Everybody's peaceful. Wouldn't it be nice to be in the land? He is at that verge, that point of suicide. And of course, in counseling, you need to be aware that people who are screaming and in despair may be at that point. But to know that there is a possibility of coming out of it, screaming, and then making the next steps to move out of it. But Job is in despair, and, well, Jennifer is in despair as well. He's going to pause there for a minute. That moment, you see, that moment of Job, of despair and of pain, is crucial, and many people feel it. And often the pious answer makes it worse. And what one has to say is, yes, it is senseless, it's bloody awful, and allow the person to say all the things, even to say the things about committing suicide, and writing them down, if that's where they're at that point. Because the actual saying of it often is precisely that which prevents it. This is what you're thinking. You need to face what you're thinking. The screaming of it and allowing it to be said and heard. Jennifer? Well. Jennifer began to blame herself. I should have known my husband would be at the bar pub. See what's beginning to happen?
Guilt.
I should have known. I should have been there to rescue my son. I should have stayed home that sad night. It's all my fault. I'm a worthless woman. I'm ashamed of myself. And even though I may have assured her, that sense of guilt kept coming up. I wondered why she felt so guilty, because it was clear it wasn't her fault. In time, she told me part of her, the other part of her story. When she was 12 years old, her uncle sexually abused her. Several times he came to babysit at Jennifer's house and took advantage of her. Once again, Jennifer was not to blame. But like so many women who are raped or abused, they feel somehow that it's their fault. And the whole event becomes so dirty, so sick and disgusting. They feel a sense of shame, and Jennifer felt that way. And we know that one in every three or four women, at least in Australian society and probably American society, have been abused. And it's an amazing number. And that sense of shame and pain often lives there and is never, ever faced. Or if it is, it's faced later in life. And the scream comes out in various ways. So I ran to understand that Jennifer needed to scream for far more than just what it is. She had to scream about her whole life because she had lost so much. One more thing in chapter 3 of Job, it's really crucial. In the midst of Job's screaming, he says something which I want to spend a few moments on. It's verse 23. Job says, why does this God put a hedge around me? That is a hedge of suffering and disaster and everything else that's gone on. Why is God, and not give me an understanding of what my way is supposed to be? Why did it happen? He goes very much to the heart of the thing in the midst of his screaming. Why did all of this happen? Why does God give me a way and then not let me able to see where it is? Where am I supposed to go? What's my point? What's the point of living? What's the point of it all? The meaning of life, that's the same question. And I need to give you a little bit of Hebrew. This word way in Hebrew, I'll give you a Hebrew word, Derek. That word way in Hebrew, every time my computer comes up, it puts a capital on it because I think it's a name. That word Derek is equivalent to that inner distinctive destiny, purpose, goal, aim that God has provided for you. Everything has its way in the Old Testament. An eagle has a way, which is to fly and soar. It knows its way. A wild animal has its way. Something built into it. It knows what to do. It knows where to go. Everything has its way. Even the thunderstorm has its way. It has its purpose, its function, its direction. And every human being is supposed to have a way. Where you're supposed to go, what you're supposed to be, what it's supposed to mean. And for Job, it's been taken. God has put a hedge of disaster and suffering around him. He has no way of knowing what's the point of life anymore. So the depths of despair and the depths of loss are extraordinary. And so Job feels not only going through denial and despair, which we had before, but this great sense of loss. He has lost all of his family. He's lost everything. He can handle that, it seems, to some extent. He's lost everything there is. And last of all, he's lost the one thing that he really wants. A sense of who he is and where he's supposed to go in life. His direct, his way. Why, God, do you give me a way and then not enable me to find out what it is? So all of this sense of loss, he has lost hope, he's lost all of his life, family, and he's lost his way. You can go on. So what you need to recognize that people will have not only a right to scream, they need a right also to be able to breathe. To breathe for everything they've lost. And there's your wailing. And the wailing doesn't just have to be connected with somebody who has died. The wailing wall in Israel is the place where you go to do just that. So the right to wail, if you like, I like that actually, the right to scream and the right to wail, to grieve over the fact that you've lost everything, including the whole point of living. So the disaster is complete. But part of the catharsis, part of the healing process, is to give people the ritual and the right and the capacity both to scream and to grieve for what they lost. The time is up.
Angus, it's
11:34. Oh, we have 10 minutes. We have 10 minutes. All right, I want to pause then. I've told you those two parts of the story. The second half of the story comes on tomorrow. And you really do need to be here for the second half. I frequently do this, and I do it as five sessions, and the fourth one after church, they'll say, Pastor, has it got a happy ending? Well, it's not a soap opera, it's not a Hollywood movie, it's the real life, and the process of how you now begin to have a way of getting people to go through and work through the suffering and the pain and the anguish. And the right to scream, the right to grieve, is there, it's given to you in this book. And that's important. Now I ask one more question. To pull this together. And that's the question. Does Jesus ever get to this point where he says the right words in his suffering? Does it ever get to the point where Jesus, first of all, is in, as it were, in denial and says, well, who remembers?
Garden of Gethsemane.
Good.
Take that cup away from me.
He said, I would like you to take away the suffering, but nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. At the first part of the garden, he's in precisely that point. Thy will be done.
And I think when he goes back and sees the disciples sleeping and he yells at them, I'm sure he yelled at them. He didn't.
What the hell? I'm going through hell and you're sleeping. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can imagine. Thank you for that. That's an insight that will always be there now. Every time I read that. Yes. Because a little later, you see, a little later, in Matthew's version of this, in Matthew's version of it, is not just that he says, I'm going to go and pray. And he tells them, I'm going to go and pray. And the sweat was on his head like drops of blood. He's going through hell. And then he says, I am what? Close to death. I don't have to, there's no reference, it's not a reference to the crucifixion. Directions to the pain and the anguish he's going through. Jesus is at the point of suicide where he says, I am grieving unto death.
Jesus has lost everything or is losing, is about to lose everything. All the things that are around him. Isn't he? And the scream comes. And the lust comes. But Jesus, and the high point of Jesus' scream is what?
Why
has he
forsaken me?
Jesus screams at God on the cross. Why have you forsaken me? You can't just make that a nice piece of piety. That's going through hell. That's a real human being crying. And it's not just a quote from Psalm 70:22. It's the real, a crying, something that was familiar to him. And so you have Jesus going through all of the same emotions that Job and Jennifer do. And you know that this Jesus is with whoever is going through it, because this is Jesus.
As human as you can get.
Suffers with you, as has he has suffered from the beginning. No.
Happened to Jennifer, but that's tomorrow.
But you know, I don't know of anybody in the world that didn't go through something. Everybody has one thing in their life that they.
Most people do. That's right. And so often you see, when you hear sermons, you just get an answer which doesn't really face it. Now, when I did the first sermons about this in my congregation where I go, did this series, lots of people came and talked about things that they had never talked about, because they had dared to say it in the pulpit. So it had more weight. And, people did come. And I screamed, and I found out. Now, what we'll do tomorrow, some of you may not be here tomorrow afternoon because you happen to have to go and do a dish team or something. But what we did last week, after the second session, after the Friday night, we had a separate rite, ritual of healing. People who had gone through hell, and 10-15 people, and we did it next door. After the Vespers, just quietly go over, and then I have a ritual of healing which gives you the right to scream, and a number of other steps. And then the actual laying on of hands with the rite of healing that I use, all based on the stuff that you've had. And it's really, you don't have to come, but if people would like to after, we might probably do it again tomorrow night.
I'd recommend it. We arrived on Friday, so we're kind of doing this backwards. We did the healing, now we're doing session one, and we're going to miss session two because we're leaving today.
You were there, that's right. Yeah. That's right. You just came.
It's really good, though.
Okay. So that will probably happen. I'll just have to organize it. It's not on the schedule at the moment. And we don't make a big thing of it, but it is. Nor do I. And what we do in Adelaide is that we actually have it as part of the Eucharist as well. So that when you come to the Eucharist, you can have the body and the blood. And then I or somebody else will be it. At one point, when people said no to me, then I'll get a healing blessing. So the healing power of the body and blood of Christ is used in the healing process. That's distinctively Lutheran, but it's not used that often. So we will continue the story tomorrow of Job, Jennifer, and Jesus, and we're going to be here.
They're
leaving today.
Mm-hmm. That's why they want to know the end.
there is a positive ending, but there is a struggle that goes on before the ending happens. It's very important.
I'll tell you when you.
You can get. By the way, you can get the tape from last week if you want to.
Okay.
Buy it at the end of the bookstore.
Or listen to it before you leave. I'm late.
Okay. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Actually, I'm a professor at the university, but I'm also do some part-time classes at work at Lutheran Church in Adelaide.
Yeah, go on.
Thank you.